have of in just absolute devotion to everything that makes up the whole story. And because even the seemingly smallest details can often be the most important ones of all, which is something that I've learned, I've been learning over the only the last few years, is subtlety. not my strong suit. But one of his great players, who had an illustrious career in the NBA after he graduated from Ralph Miller's teaching, described him as, he's the kind of guy that if you asked him what time it was, pretty soon you would know how to build a clock. And I'm like that, and your answer to how you got into doing interviews and why is exactly like that. I know now how to build that very fine clock that I was just admiring. I really do deeply appreciate that, because everyone has superpowers that we are born with. Crawling out of the cradle, statistically speaking, everyone on the planet Earth has a minimum of 5 superpowers. That's 7 or above on a scale of 1 to 10 in areas of talent. And I assert one of my superpowers is I can spot superpowers in other people. To such a degree that I have made a lot of people uncomfortable just talking to them about it. Like I even, like they feel like I peeked at them naked. And most people are oblivious to those superpowers.
Yes.
Completely. And they are paid accordingly.
Everyone has superpowers.
And what's that?
Everyone has at least 5 superpowers.
At least minimum of 5. And if we dug a little deeper, as you and I are capable of doing, because that's our superpower, we like get the whole story, we could probably come up with a dozen more that they are at least an elite talent at. But the problem is, most people are completely oblivious to those things. School systems don't teach those that approach. And we walk around totally oblivious to our own awesomeness to such an incredible degree, it just hurts. But if you sat down, and I know you've done this time and time again, because I've done the same, but if you just sit down with people and just like dig in a little about what, you know, really matters to them, the experiences that they're proud of that they truly enjoyed, and all, you know, all the great stuff that makes people fun to talk to, you know, we get to uncover those superpowers. Mm-hmm. And those people grow 10-foot tall right in front of our very eyes. And then if you're able to have them understand that and instill that in them, they will grow 10-foot tall in their own eyes. And all of a sudden, what you have is you have a whole brand new set of skills and so forth that they can approach their life with, either apply it to their existing career or scrap that crappy job and go do something that suits them better. And all of that stuff is, the program I'm developing is called Find and Flex Your Superpowers. Because it's not enough to know about them.
Yeah.
You got to go out and do something now. I spotted the talent. Now it's time to go do something.
Something about it. So my first question now is, you know, what is a superpower? You know, so we can have something we agree on.
Well, there's a scale of 1 to 10 measuring. We'll just use a 1 to 10 scale because it's commonly done as a measuring stick. One of the biggest lies ever told, and I know you've heard it before, is that with hard work, your greatest weakness will become your greatest strength.
Yeah.
That's one of the biggest lies ever told.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the arena of talent, in the arena of character, if one is naturally bitchy or naturally flaky, is their, you know, general inclination, be ruthless with yourself as the autumn frost until your very last breath. If I'm naturally flaky and chronically late, I can set 10 alarms on my phone and aim to be everywhere 1 hour before I think I need to be there to be on time. And I'll usually be about 10 minutes early. That's a great example of managing a character weakness, or, you know, brain wiring weakness. That actually is a thing I forget the name of it, but it is a symptom of brain injury. Is people there's a certain percentage of the population that does not understand, their brain cannot compute the passage of time. And so they're chronically late. And that's why God invented the multiple alarm telephone calendar. Use that thing for, and those are the kinds of things that you can, you know, that you manage as, I don't want to call that a character flaw so much, but as if that's how your brain works, this is how you manage it. Manage your things that you got to manage to, you know, do what you need to do. Like, I just found out somebody, you know, you can cut a house key for $3 in this country. She owns like 9 house keys because she kept losing them. They're one in each jacket, one in the travel bag, one in the purse. And then there's one hanging in a big ring off her front doorknob. And there's a box, she put an empty cardboard box in front of her doorknob with the key on with the house key on the big ring hanging on that doorknob, so that she'd never miss a house key. That's a great example of, you know, some people call it a character flaw, but that's a great example for managing for how, you know, the shit hand you were dealt in brain wiring in that area. Which, by the way, that's a brilliantly clever solution. Which points to her superpower. She comes up with brilliant, clever solutions to downright heartbreakingly infuriating problems. But in areas of actual talent, there was a study conducted by the United States Olympic Committee in which they paid a team of well over 20 PhDs to research for well over 20 years all the factors required to win an Olympic gold medal. And I have a great reverence for good scientific method, not the bad kind, but good scientific method. But I don't have the brain to slog through all the details of studies. I like to read the summaries. So I'll summarize it. Here's the summary of the guy that ran that team of PhDs. Here he summarized his over 20 years of research. He said the single most important factor in earning an Olympic gold medal is how carefully you chose your biological parents. In other words, pick a sport you're genetically suited to be good at. And it is quite rare, which is why we celebrate Olympians, it's quite rare to have both the exceptional talent and the exceptional interest and the exceptional work ethic, all three in the same package.
Yes. So the exceptional talent, the exceptional work ethics was the third one.
And the exceptional interest.
Exceptional interest.
In putting in that work ethic. Because pick me, for instance, if you wanted to dial up an enduro bicycle road racer, 6 hours and longer, and actually the longer it goes after 6 hours, the more I am the guy to beat, and people are going to be eating my dust, or since it rains up here in Seattle a lot, eating my rooster tail if the race is 12 hours or longer. Because I was born with a vast quantity of slow and a decent quantity of medium twitch muscle fiber, that I can dial up the heart rate to 155 beats a minute. And as long as I'm properly fuel and hydrate, I can do that for 36 straight hours with a few naps.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and the bike fits correctly. It doesn't hurt my ass, right? You got to change it. That's what broke me into coaching, actually, was doing that. I mailed off in 1983. I was 18 years old. I was a juvenile delinquent burger flipper. And I moved to Seattle and mailed off my entry fee for the Seattle to Portland double century. That's 200 miles in a single day. I was number 700 and something out of 1,000 when only 1,000 people thought that on planet Earth thought that was a good idea. But I worked it around working full time at night, flipping burgers and then going out and closing down punk rock bars because I was a delinquent. And then I fit my training schedule around that. And in digging into all of that, first of all, I could do my standard ride for just regular maintenance was about 80 miles. I could do that 7 days a week before breakfast, after I'd worked all night, because the only guy that was that could have covered my shift the night before the big event, me and him really didn't like each other, and I knew he'd be a hard no. I knew it. So what I would do is I would work deep into the night, get off work, stay up till dawn, and hit the road. And then sleep until it's time to go to work again. I did that 7 days a week. And yes, I was gifted with that amount, that huge quantity of slow twitch and medium twitch muscle fiber that allowed me to go very fast for very long distances. But I also had the keen interest. And the thing about being a delinquent and flipping burgers is the pay is low and being a delinquent is expensive.
It is.
And I'm sure you're familiar with it, given where you come from money. I know maybe yourself and certainly your peers in that, in your socioeconomic bracket will confirm that bicycle racing is a very expensive sport.
Yes.
Bicycle road racing is, it's one of the few sports that ordinary people, it's not like dressage, where only people with lots of money can do it. Even the dirt poorest can get on a bike and, you know, put a brick on the accelerator. I found that sweat was the great equalizer. I found also that when you don't have much money and if you're doing the sport of bicycle racing correctly, you are wearing out and breaking expensive gear all the time. So I had to flex my ingenuity because I had no money, because I wouldn't get paid nothing. Plus I had a delinquent habit to keep up. And so I got to understand how to do time management and how to work around, you know, do the things to my body after I'd punished it at work and punished it at the bar in the mosh pit. How to recover from that so I could go out and really do my primary mission, which was on the bike. And how to recover from all of those things, and how I learned about things like nutrition being free money, and how many times I have rolled up and smoked far superior athletes that were better trained, that had much pricier gear than me, because I understood nutrition and hydration and they did not. And so that was my original break into coaching. I did it myself, and then I started bringing other people. And by the time I was 24 years old, I had done 5 200-mile bike rides in a single day. And then also 10 24-hour-long charity benefit dance marathons. And I had brought several dozen people with me. And I found out after a while that Lance Armstrong was correct. He said it many years later. He said that every world-class athlete is running away from something. So the more terrible your life is, the more you want to run away, and you get really good at running away. And in my case, I hopped on a very fast, handmade European bicycle. And you could run a lot further, a lot faster for the price of a really terrible car. So then, circumstances being what they were, you break the bike, and then now you're on foot, and now I got to face life. So then I started finding coaches on that side of things. And so I spent the last several decades, in different various transformational disciplines, organizational development, and so forth, where I finally got to the point where I got to see that my superpower is that I can see superpowers in other people.
So let me see if I get this right. So a superpower will be something that that comes natural to you, or something you're more inclined.
That's correct. Something that you're born with, crawling out of the cradle. You're a 7 or above on a scale of 1 to 10.
You're 7 or above on the scale of 1 to 10.
On a scale of 1 to 10, crawling out of the cradle. Like for both of us, we can talk.
Yeah.
For you, you have it even more than me. You have this wonderful ease about you. We can tell that even though you're a... Whoo, boy, are you smart. You are a very smart, smart person. And you have a lot of options available to you as far as course of actions that you measure and weigh constantly with that brain of yours working. We can tell instinctively that you are not trying to game us. You have a distinct lack of guile about you. That is a superpower. You are trustworthy. Not very many people at your level, how do I say it? People at your level in life are not famous for that, because the ones that are famous for that at your level in life don't make it onto the television. It's the other ones. You know how money magnifies? Money is just a magnifier of character. So 7 out of 10 on a set, one of my superpowers is my abundant quantity of slow twitch muscle fiber.
So a superpower is something you're naturally born with that you can perform on the scale of 1 to 10, 7, 8, 9, 10.
It's starting at a 7 and maybe higher than that even, because in areas of, let's pick another superpower I don't have. Never in my life, because of the quantity of slow twitch muscle fiber that I have, could I ever get even a little bit close to dunking a basketball. although, you know, my connective tissue, and I don't have anything structurally wrong with my joints or anything like that that would keep me from dunking a basketball. I do, however, I was not gifted by my biological parents with that ability. And even at my skywalking best, when I weighed 6'3", at one point I was doing a lot of kung fu and eating a lot of spirulina and not much else, which, by the way, write that down. I know you're an athlete amongst your many other pursuits. This is my gift to whoever's going to watch, to you and to whoever's going to watch this. Spirulina. The blue green apple. 5,000 milligrams 15 minutes before you start your warm-up for your next hard, for your next workout.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Give it time to break down. I recommend the tablets because the powder is annoying to manage.
I tried that with my cup.
You can always put the powder in a drink. It's going to taste like blue green algae no matter what you do. You know you're hardcore when that stuff tastes good.
Yeah, no matter what you do everything. Put it in, it's like you're still gonna.
Part of how I earn my pay, and like everybody else does, and the great Tony Robbins describes it this way. He says, "Here, let me save you 20 years of slogging." Because you put yourself in the seat of the brand new person. You know, you want to go back and talk to you, the you that you were 20 years ago or 30 years ago when you were just starting out and you're all fired up and you want to do this thing. That's what a good coach will do. Those magic words. Let me save you 20 years of slogging.
20 years of slogging.
And I have field tested literally thousands of different foods, superfoods, supplements, et cetera, good ideas and bad. And I will tell you that 5,000 milligrams of spirulina 15 minutes before your next workout, nothing else even comes a little bit close. Because it goes right through the stomach wall, right to the muscle. It doesn't have to get broke down in the GI tract. It contains glycogen that does not have to be synthesized in your liver. Goes right to the muscle. It's a one-celled plant, breaks right down, goes right to the muscle. It also has 5 different dark chlorophylls that buffer the toxic corrosive byproduct of you shredding your muscles while you're working hard. I am able to overclock my heart rate by 14 beats a minute to this day at age 56 when I use it versus when I don't. Try it and see, and you'll do the same thing that I do every time I do that for my pre-workout. I'll look down, I'll be hammering away, and I'll be thinking, oh, I'm not in this kind of shape. How come I don't feel dirty? So that's my free gift of value to all watching this. But I can still, no matter how I try, no matter if I kept an Olympic training schedule for 20 years, because of the vast quantities of slow and medium twitch muscle fiber that I possess, I would still never be able to dunk a basketball. My connective tissue's not busted, so I charitably say I'm a 2 on a scale of 1 to 10 in my ability to dunk a basketball.
So one of the things I see that you do is, you know, you said you not only look for the strengths, you're also able to identify the weaknesses and not to bother with that, you know.
Yeah, stop wasting your time trying to polish a turd. I am a enduro 12 hour and longer athlete. Especially on a bicycle, because the road racing bicycles require a degree. You have to, the smoother you are, the easier your form is to put power to the pedal, the faster and further you will go. So it rewards really kind of a lazy approach. You got to find the sweet spots. or you will be done early. If you try, God, if you try and muscle it up, you will be done early. But you gotta settle in and relax and find the relaxed sweet spot. That's why when you go to YouTube and look at the Tour de France, all their legs are moving like hummingbird wings, and they're just kind of leaning on their bars, you know, their hands kind of, they got their elbows on their handlebars and stuff like that. Because they pedal 35,000 miles a year for money. Mm. Best to make yourself comfortable. Mm-hmm. So it rewards a certain, in addition to a certain kind of, you know, musculoskeletal structure, it rewards a certain type of mindset. Mm-hmm. Personality type that you're born with.
So personality
we get into, is we, part of what we get into, not only talents, you know, the pick something that you have the genetic talent to be good at. Mm-hmm. For me, if I kept an Olympic training schedule to dunk a basketball, I would have wasted 20 years of my time polishing a turd. Because you can go up to John Maxwell, I'm sure you heard of him, world's leading educator in organizational development and leadership,
yes.
Wrote over 30 books.
Yes.
His talk on this subject, this is what changed my life. He's talking about the big lie of work real hard, your greatest weakness will become your greatest strength. That's a lie. In areas of natural talent. If your talent is weak for dunking a basketball, it's always gonna be weak. If you keep an Olympic training schedule, you're a 2 on a scale of 1 to 10, you can move up 2 rating points. So you'll get all the way to less than mediocre after 20 years of hard effort. Meanwhile, everything that was a 7 on a scale and above on a scale of 1 to 10 has been left to rot.
Yeah.
And it will be an endless source of frustration for you and all your teammates on the basketball team. And any good coach will yank you right out of there and have you do something else. Which, by the way, is why so many, the landscape is littered with Hall of Fame players who are terrible coaches because you can't teach talent. The landscape is also littered with bench warmer players who are Hall of Fame coaches. A really good organization to study as far as coaching and all that needs organizational development, high quality functional organization, is your Seattle Seahawks NFL football team. Head coach Pete Carroll holds the distinction. He won the most games as a head coach at the Division I college level, the highest winning percentage. His teams played in back-to-back national championships. He won the first one and came within a couple seconds and a couple inches of winning 2 in a row. Then he came to Seattle as head coach, and everybody thought he'd never make it because he has this thing about treating his players good. And if any of his assistant coaches, it's one thing to yell because you're a coach and it's football. But if you yell anything insulting to anybody, especially a player, you are fired on the spot. You won't be back. And there's a conventional, this hidebound conventional wisdom in that sport that you can only succeed one way, which is treating your players like crap.
Yes.
And they thought he'd never make it because he's all fired up and rah-rah. They call him pom-pom, you know, like the cheerleader, right? And he came to Seattle and he landed and he's all pumped about this and jacked about that and pumped about this. We made up a new word in his honor, pump jacked. I'm super pump jacked to be here, you know. And he brought that, he played music at practice, which is something that you never do because you're supposed to treat your players like crap, you know. And he made Seattle into a destination, a high demand destination for not only college players just coming out of the draft, but also veteran players that played for other, you know, other coaches that were jerks. they all want everybody want to come here. And his teams played in back-to-back Super Bowls up here. Won the first one in a blowout, and in the second one it was a couple seconds and a few inches away from winning that one too. He's part of an extremely exclusive fraternity of head coaches that own national championship rings at both the college and pro level, own championship rings at both college and pro level. And the only one that I'm aware of that both at the pro and the college level played in back-to-back championship games. And the defenses that he is, because there's an adage that offenses are pretty and defenses win championships. Mm-hmm. And the defense, the Legion of Boom defenses that from 2012 to 2015, 2011 to 15, there was a 4-year span. I think it was 2011 to 2014. In 2010, he took over a team where people's career, you know, it was bad, really, really bad. A lot of has-beens, never was, you know, a lot of people that didn't belong in the league. And so he turned that roster. He set a record. There was over 270 player transactions where you cut one guy and bring in another in the year 2010. There was one particular player that was left over from the previous coach on that team that was stinking it up. The guy's name was Red Bryant. He played defensive tackle in college. That's the great big guy in the middle, mm-hmm. 350-pounder.
Yeah.
His job is to eat up blockers so the fancy guys in the back can go make plays. Mm-hmm. That's mostly what he did. That was his job. And the physics of playing interior line in football means low man wins. Whoever's the lowest gets leverage and wins the battle.
Yes.
Against whoever they're playing against. Problem was, our 350-pound Red Bryant, who is gifted with all of that explosive muscle power, was 6'5". And when you're gifted with the muscle power to bench press a house as a small child, and to squat two houses as a small child, one of the other things you're often gifted with, if you're able to play the game of football, is you have an excessive amount of connective tissue around your joints to handle all of that explosive power. Mm-hmm. He had a problem, is there was so much reinforcing connective tissue around his hips, he couldn't get low enough to do the job at the professional level. So for all his, and he had, but he had that terrific, terrific attitude, man. He was just the most, not only the sunny disposition, but the Mr. Intensity. And he kept everyone in line, because when 6'5" and 350 and really glad to be here, he will cure the attitude problem before you even hear about it there, coach.
Yeah.
So he had that sparkling personality in addition to Mr. Intensity. Hit everything except for the part where he couldn't physically do the job. So they called him into the office one day, the head coach and general manager. He said, I thought for sure they were going to cut me. They sat him down. I said, Red, we notice you're 6'5", you weigh 350, you can squat two houses, bench press one house, but you can't get low enough to do the job. Would it be all right if we moved you to this other position over here, right? Defensive end. Usually that's the flashy guys that, you know, get to, you know, run down quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. And the right tackles in the league are accustomed to playing against guys that weigh about 90 pounds less than you do. We noticed, in addition to your being enormous and incredible, you got an Olympic, these strong like an Olympic powerlifter. We noticed that your get off from your, you know, from that little, you know, that sprinter's crouch that they do, your get off is about as quick as Usain Bolt over about a 5-yard area. And your arms, you have the arms, you know, the reach of an NBA center. Plus, you can bench press like 550 pounds. So here's what we'd like you to do. Line up against guys that are accustomed to playing against every week, playing against people that weigh 80 pounds less than you do. And just hit them and drive them back like they're on roller skates. Can you do that for us? He said, sure, let's see how that works.
Let's see how that goes, yeah.
Because you're not cutting me, right? You're not firing me?
No.
Okay. And when you watch Seattle Seahawks from 2010, he got injured in 2010. They put him over there and it worked great. Because what he did, he never did get to, he didn't get very many tackles, which you expect a lot of from that position. He didn't get sacks, which is the other thing you expect from a player at that position. But what he did was he collapsed the entire right, every play that he was on, he collapsed the entire right side of every team's opposing offense. It doesn't matter how good a team it was. And any play that ran to the right side had to run around a great big mess. They had to run around a 350-pound man pushing two 280-pound men backwards on roller skates. Usually two, because there's nobody, no one guy can handle them. There's two to three guys getting pushed backwards into your lap there, Mr. Right-Handed Quarterback. What are you going to do? Oh, hand it off to the runner. He's got to get around that mess. So what that did was it allowed the guy that was, they put a guy that was way too big to play the position in that position. Mm-hmm. And then they had a guy that was way too small to play the position on the other side, run them all down from behind. There was only two players on those defenses that set the best defense in the history of the game at any level. There were only two players that were the actual prototype, what you really look for when you're evaluating a player. All the rest of them, too big, too small, too slow. But Pete Carroll didn't give a crap about how too big, too small, or too slow they were. He looked to see what they did best. And what he did was he assembled, there was 11 guys, there's 11 guys on the field. He had two players that are going to the Hall of Fame at their positions because they're the prototype. That's exactly what you want at that position as far as all their measurables. But that leaves 10 other guys that didn't belong, that were passed over in the draft or cut by other teams or traded for a six pack and a pizza to his team, that he put in a position where all he asked them to do is what they do best. And all those other things you ain't any good at, we're never gonna ask you to do those things. Because we got a guy playing right next to you that's really good at that thing, and he happens to suck at that thing you do best. And that they call themselves the Legion of Boom. They are the best defense to ever play in the history of the game. Because he looked at, we don't give a crap what you can't do. What you can't do is painfully obvious to everyone. You'd rather not talk about it either now, would you?
Yeah. Exactly.
Let's look at what can you do, and then let's do that.
Let's do that. Mm.
And we'll line up somebody who's brilliant at the thing you suck at because you are brilliant at the thing he sucks at and he's playing next to you. And I can tell you, having had way too many jobs, because I am brilliant at certain things and really terrible at other things. that other people take for granted that I ought to be competent at. I've had a lot of jobs. And what I can tell you from a training standpoint, that I worked at Amazon. That's how I got into coaching in the first place. I was injured. I had a lot of time. I got injured trying to make great at Amazon. And they run an algorithm. It's a meat grinder algorithm. They do not factor in at all that there are human beings that they're running through their algorithm. And that each one of those human beings has individual strengths and weaknesses. And that if you do not account for their strengths and their weaknesses, they're just, you're going to grind them up and spit them out. The other big deal, I started putting together Find and Flex Your Superpowers as my, you know, go-to course, as what I coach to.
Yeah.
Because that's one of my superpowers, is spotting those things.
Yeah.
And what I ran into, and I've had a lot of training from a lot of very top quality organizations, as far as, you know, transformational learning modalities, transformational coaching techniques, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, conventional and woo-woo, and famous ones for leadership and organizational development, world-renowned. And I got a lot out of it. I'm a glittering talent. I remember a lot of stuff from it, except for the part where I can routinely break coaches.
Mm.
Because I got all this talent, and at the same time I've had, you know, brain injuries and things like that. My brain, there's a lot of material that is taught, written and delivered in the learning style of whoever is teaching it, which is not mine. So I don't care how important it is, I'm not learning it because I don't speak that language. Just like there's distinct, you probably heard of the five love languages.
Yes.
There's five distinct ways humans express love. And if you're not speaking their language, they don't think you love them.
Yeah. Yes.
No, how hard you're working.
Yes. I always say that when people say you don't love me anymore, you don't care about me anymore, what they're really saying is that you don't show me in the way that I want to be shown.
You're not speaking my language. You're hollering in Swahili from the rooftops how much you love them. They're standing on the ground crying to themselves in Mandarin Chinese. Why are you so annoying and why don't you love them?
Yeah.
Yeah, stop hollering. Go take out the garbage. Yeah, by the way, when my wife uses her vicious New York mouth to say something nice to me, I know it's a learned response. She's only doing it because she loves me and she would never do it for anybody else. So she gets double credit. When I take out the garbage, do the dishes, rub her feet, I'm only doing it because I love her.
So that would be acts of service?
That's correct. She's an acts of service girl. I'm a words of affirmation guy. And just like there's distinct love languages, I'm partnered up with someone who's devoted, ever since she was 8 years old, she's now 40. She's devoted the last 32 years to studying how human brains work. Everything from, you know, the really hard academic psychology testing, you know, brain function testing, all the way through love languages to the woo-woo stuff like Vedic astrology, all the way to let's go take a look at your World of Warcraft profile. Because that'll say something about your personality too.
Yes.
And so on and so on. And she is like deeply immersed in all that stuff. She confirmed that there are actually even a dozen different ways that human beings learn. Learning styles. But that is a concept so hard, difficult to compute for most people who went to school and only learned two of them, that they narrowed it down to that there's seven learning styles with five subcategories of learning styles. And in putting together Find and Flex, you know, the materials for Find and Flexers for superpowers,
what I was bumping up against was, this is my, not only my superpower, but this is my number one area of fascination of all. Why am I not picking up this material that I'm studying? Well, the answer is, it is formatted in a way that does not speak to my learning style. So, as a prereq, my entry-level, our entry-level course work is always going to be learn your learning style.
Learn your learning style.
Because most people have no idea. Most people have absolutely no idea. And the way Einstein said it was, just because a fish, when you tell a fish to climb a tree, if they're not able, if the fish isn't able to climb a tree, it doesn't mean the fish is stupid. And I'm excited for you and bless you that you come from a family tree that recognizes talent. And that recognize that there's more that they say somewhere in the backwoods of America, which is, you know, the roots of my people, where you know how there's blue collar workers and white collar workers. I'm a no collar worker.
No collar worker.
I put on my good Sunday go to meeting T-shirt here for this interview. Amongst the no-collar workers, that there's more than one approach. There's more than one way to skin a cat.
Yes.
I loves me some colloquialisms. I get a huge kick out of that stuff. It says so much about a culture and subculture. And there's so many subcultures within a culture. So there's more one way. So learn your learning style.
Who do you typically want to help?
Well, both one-on-one and organization.
Okay.
Everybody needs to know this about themselves. And they need to be able to recognize it and speak to it in others. Both one-on-one, like, there's books you haven't read. There's materials that you know are a good idea to know that you don't know. Because it's a slog to try to learn it. And the most frustrating part about it for brilliant, fascinated people that are brilliant and fascinated, which everybody is within their own personal scope, within their own talent level, with talent, respective talents. The most frustrating thing on earth for smart people, and everybody's smart in their particular ways.
Yeah.
Is knowing that you're smart, but you're dumb as a rock trying to learn something. And you're not picking it up. And the teacher's no help because they're teaching it in a way that they know how to, that they know how to learn it. And that's not yours. They're not speaking your language, so they're calling you stupid. And everybody is brilliant. I love that we are all brilliant. And we are all idiots. The important question to engage in both times is at what? And a huge part of uncovering your brilliance is understanding how you can learn something.
Understanding how you learn.
Understanding how you learn.
So that's the first step. So what's the second stage?
Well, first of all, identifying how you learn things.
Yes.
And then anything you want to learn, get it in that, get it, do it that way. Like, there's a whole subset of people. I'm one of them. My oracle, Maestra Rachel, friend of mine, she put out an open call on social media, highly accomplished person, does global business, et cetera, et cetera. Was looking at going back to medical school, going to medical school, but she had not yet finished her undergraduate degree. And she had trepidation about going through all those years of schooling because she had trouble academically. So she wrote a 3-sentence description of her concerns about going back to school and the trouble that she had academically. I sent it over to Rachel, and she proceeded to give, five or six of those one minute voice shots on Messenger. And then another couple of paragraphs in writing. Oh, she has thus and such learning style. She would best be served going on the internet and just jumping down rabbit holes by herself. Because if she went to a class to learn the same information with a bunch of other people and somebody talking at her from the front of the room, she'll never learn jack. Whereas there's lots of other people that's the best way they learn. Not this one. She'd flunk out. Like she did. She didn't finish her undergraduate degree. That little bit of analysis right there probably saved her $100,000 in tuition. Because she's looking at going to school for 8 years. And there's tons of prereqs you can do online. When you just go jump down the rabbit hole the way she does best. So identifying how you learn and then gathering the materials that you want to learn in a way that you can learn.
In the way that you can learn. Mm.
Step one. And then step two, identifying what your best talents are.
That would be the superpower.
That's correct.
What's the difference between a superpower and a talent? How do you differentiate though?
They're kind of interchangeable. Like when I say best talent, it's superpower. We all have various talents. We all have various aptitudes. We can be pretty good. We can be at least competent at a lot of things. Mm-hmm. We can downright consistently good at a fair number of things. Mm-hmm. We can be really excellent at still a good number of things. And we can be absolutely stratospheric, and at least stratospheric, nobody else on earth, like few on earth could ever do, in minimum of 5 things. And that's the superpower, your greatest talents. Identifying those things. And then the next step after that is mapping that on to either your chosen field of endeavor, whatever that might be, or scrapping the dumb idea you thought you were going to do that turns out it really was a dumb idea.
Yeah.
And finding something else that really suits you best.
Suits that superpower. Yes. Where your superpower shines.
And flexing that superpower and learning to do so in the manner in which you learn best. Because I can tell you, having experienced Amazon and a whole bunch of other places, I've seen some really ridiculous things in the workplace. I was out of work for a while, got into coaching, was injured, recovered from injury, re-entered the workforce. It was a small bicycle shop up here in Seattle, Alki Bike and Board, terrific outfit. They've been in business since 1937. The current owner has owned the place since 1987. They're working on like fourth and fifth generations coming in there of, treasured customers. People come from hours away that grew up in the neighborhood because that's still their home shop. And they were the most well-oiled machine. We call it a seat of the pants operation. You familiar with the term? Flying by the seat of your pants?
No, I'm not familiar with that term.
Well, there's a term. It originated back when airplanes really didn't have instruments. You had in fact, there's a really great film called Rush.
Rush.
It's some year, it was about the rivalry between the human computer, the Austrian Niki Lauda, the professional race, Formula One race driver, who lived the life of a monk. And his brain, he had this giant computer of a brain, and he was down to everything exactly so, et cetera. And it was the rivalry between him and James Hunt, who was a beer-drinking derelict, who did everything by the seat of his pants. He was, you know, Mr. Precision Operation versus Mr. Seat of the Pants. And it was a spectacular rivalry. It was the year that they battled it out for the Formula One World Championship. And there's a scene in which Niki Lauda, the utterly humorless, downright surly computer for a brain, quintessential Germanic, utterly lacking in social graces, downright rude, gets a ride. This is the crucial moment where he meets his wife, which, by the way, he's still married to her. And if you ever get a look at Marlene Lauda, woo, bombshell, all the fellas just fall right over, you know, just like you get stupid in the presence of a she's absolutely stunning to this day.
Marlene Lauda?
Marlene, his wife Marlene. And he meets her, and they're, you know, they're driving in the Italian countryside. She's driving. He's sitting in the passenger seat, and she's singing along to a song, and she's stunningly beautiful in this stunningly beautiful section. You know, any regular guy would be swooning. He turns off the radio and he says, "Your fan belt is loose."
Yeah. Oh, I think I've seen it. It's an old movie.
She turns back on the radio and starts singing along beautifully, blah, 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 blah. He turns it off again. He goes, "Your fan belt is loose, yes, and your left rear tire is low." She said, "I just got it out of the garage." He said, "Your fan belt is loose and your left rear tire is low." She says to him, "Oh, you think you're so smart?" He says, "No, I am only of average intelligence, but I have a very sensitive ass."
Yes, yeah, I
remember. "Your fan belt is loose and your left rear tire is low." And nobody talks to a woman like that, like that. And she's pretty irritated about it until the car breaks down on the side of the road because the fan belt was loose. And then it was off to the, you know, and then that's the unlikely story of, you know, boy meets girl. That's how he ended up meeting the woman that he married. And that is why he was just doing what he did best.
I think he was really driving slow, and she was wondering why a racer would be driving slow, you know.
That's right. He said, "Because I have no reason to drive fast."
I have no reason to drive fast. Mm.
Yeah, and that's example of that brilliant precision mind. He's got an algorithm for a brain. And then, you know, the guys letting him drive their car said, "Oh man, would you please drive it fast?" So he did, and then he went nuts, you know, the way he does. But the other guy, James Hunt, see the movie, right? He's a beer drinking derelict.
Yes.
He, by his own admission, the only thing he was good at is driving a car like he stole it. Mm-hmm. 100% seat of the pants all the time. Mm. His brains, he didn't have much in the way of a cerebral cortex at all. This all brainstem and ass. Mm. He could tell you about the car in colorful language, but he could not begin to tell you, you know, substitute this material for that material and dial the camber and the caster this way and that way, the way Lauda does. So it's a classic algorithm versus seat of the pants, both wildly successful. So I went from algorithm that chewed me up and spit me out to this seat of the pants operation. Smoothest running seat of the pants operation I've ever seen in my life. Nothing written down, no system. The structure is you jump in and you dance. But the problem was, if you are not accustomed to wearing that particular brand of trousers and you don't already know the dance steps, there's no way they can teach you. I didn't last 2 weeks because of that. They couldn't teach me, no matter how hard they tried. I was a source of endless frustration to them. I couldn't pick it up. They thought I was lazy. And out of that, I got to figure out that for me, you know, this is when I started breaking into learning styles, that for me, if I'd have had somebody standing behind me, because what they did was they showed me this ridiculous outdated computer system. There's 12 steps to do everything. So you do this, do that. Oh yeah, write this down. You do this, do that, do this, do that, do this, do that. Okay, there you go. I got to go. I'm busy. Whereas if I'd have had one of them stand behind me and whisper in my ear what the correct thing to do next was, if I faltered, like in theater where you have the person reading along with the script during practice and you say line and they tell you the next line, if they'd have done that for me in, you know, half an hour per task, frankly, if I'd have took video of it and looked at the video later and listen to the audio and then have somebody stand behind me when I, you know, slow down, I'd have picked it all up. I'd be their sales manager right now. I'd be breaking records for them because doing what I do best.
Yes.
But I couldn't learn it the way they were teaching me. So I just was an endless source of frustration to them, and the feeling was mutual. So I went from the biggest, smooth, perfectly smooth running operation meat grinder to the smallest, perfectly smooth, perfect. Their system is perfection. If your learning style is theirs.
It is.
Same with Amazon. So, and then, you know, having had more jobs than my wife recommends that I, tell anyone, I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt, that isn't how everyone's training system, that's how the education system is set up. And that is how every organization, whether it's business or other, is set up on how to teach and train people. It's set up by how the teachers and the trainers learn it, not how the people that are doing the learning learn it.
Okay, set up.
So they're lucky if they can retain 10 to 20% of the people they bring in, can pick the system, their systems up fast enough for them to be good at it before they get cut loose. Or they just quit out of frustration because they're not picking it up. So it's scalable for one-on-one, because you'll want to know it. Scalable for one-on-one to the organizational level.
Yes.
And and then outside of that, there's some other things, other projects that I'm working on. One of them is about money. And all of the conventional courses that I've ever seen about, well, first of all, conventional wisdom about money is written by people that have a lot of money that will tell you that you have to keep cutting back. You have to get the under butler to fire the upstairs maid and stop drinking the 11, $22 cups of coffee that you must be drinking every day, or otherwise you would have money, and don't be lazy. And all of those things are utter bullshit.
Yes.
Because there is generational trauma associated with money amongst people who don't have money and also amongst people who do have money.
Yes.
In fact, the people that have some of the most money are the ones inflicting that trauma on everybody else. They're hoarding. I've been learning this because, you know, there's the plague on in the United States and so, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. Here's one for you. If you give it somebody who doesn't work at all, give them $1,000. Just hand it to them. Here's what they're going to do. They're going to, first of all, they're going to pay their power and light bill and their rent. So everybody at the power and light company and the landlord and everybody like that, the property management company that, you know, it's, you know, it has to hire people to patch the roof and things like that. Everybody got paid and all them people got employed. Then they're going to take the money, you hand them another $1,000, they're going to walk outside and they're going to put gas in their car and they're going to go get groceries and they're going to buy beer and cigarettes and drugs and all those things. All the people that have money hate them for. And then the people that sold them all that stuff get to take that money and do the same exact thing. So by the time nightfall occurs, you know, by the end of the week, that $1,000 will have passed through dozens of hands. It will have employed literally, physically, dozens of people. Go get it. That lazy person that spent that $1,000 that doesn't have the job, doesn't want one and won't get one, took that $1,000 and spent it with a whole bunch of go-getters at their places of business, the food, the gas, and the drug dealer even, who then took that money and spent it themselves in the economy and also to help, you know, build out more infrastructure to invest in their go-getter business. So by the end of the week, that $1,000 will have caused, that will have put hundreds of meals on the table for hundreds of people. Even though you gave it to the lazy guy who is not working. Whereas, and I'm sure you can confirm this better than I can, that if you give that $1,000 to somebody that's got, that has to, that weighs their money instead of counting it, they're going to stash it somewhere in the Cayman Islands and take it completely out of circulation. That $1,000 will never again see the light of day. It gets removed from the economy. It'll never circulate again, ever. It'll employ a banker in the Cayman Islands, but that's just one guy in a room full of servers. So I don't know how I got on that subject. I got, you know, you get injured, you get time to
take money, which is one of the projects that you
healing money trauma. That's a hoarding money, hoarding anything. If you hoarded newspapers or cats, you'd get on TV and everybody look at you. They'd send mental health professionals over and a crew to clear out your house. And, you know, everybody'd know you are sick in the head. But if you hoard money to such a degree that it is physically damaging the population and the, you know, the world economy, because you're hoarding it, they put you on the cover of magazines as exemplary, as someone to be that everyone should be like. And I know you know that one better than I. You've met these people.
Yes.
You know, they got $100 million, but they won't tip because they're afraid of losing money. Oh, yes. And that's, those are the people that we justifiably love to hate. Because ain't that some shit? That is trauma right there. And then what they do is they, you know, take their money trauma and inflict it on the rest of us by not paying us to do our jobs. So we, you know, the primary, I just learned this, a psych nurse, you know, the one you call on ER for mental health issues, emergency mental health issues. She said the number one cause by far, and it ain't even close, of mental illness is poverty.
Well, poverty is the number one cause of mental health issues.
Mental health issues, that's correct.
Wow.
When you raise the minimum wage, the suicide rate goes down. When you raise the minimum wage, the domestic violence rate goes down. And those are the kinds of things that are a function, you know, those, you know, especially violence that inflicts trauma. Violence, you know, trauma physically rewires the brain. And we all have, it is very, very rare. I'm thinking you're probably one of the rare exceptions. But regardless of socioeconomic bracket, no money, lots of money, most people have trauma around money. So one of my other course offerings that we're developing is healing your money trauma, healing our money trauma, I'll call it that way, because we all have it in some form or another. Even you who are so happy and well-adjusted, sometimes money will just kind of sneak up on you and make you its bitch, right? So you plug those three, learn your learning style, find and flex your superpower, heal your money trauma, into a business organization. What'll happen to you on an individual basis? You master those three things, and you have somebody that's already has those things mastered that you can call upon. What will that do for you? Sky's the limit, right?
Sky's the limit, yeah.
What will that do for an organization when I have your entire, you know, all 100 of your sales crew go through those three courses, and then I have all 300 of your logistics and delivery crew go through all those three. Your HR department, your training and development, your research and development and training departments. They go through all those things. All of a sudden, what you have is you have a really highly functional organization that doesn't waste time or resources, that develops people who are doing what they do best, and everybody can afford to be, you know, the bottom line can afford to pay them according to what they do best. So those are my three things that we're doing.
Oh, thank you very much for sharing that. And for those who want to, you know, who really connect to the stories, the message, you know, and how can they reach you? Like, what's the way to be in contact with your business?
I'm still building out my infrastructure. So my current reachability, my name is Ken Hill. You can see my smiling mug on Facebook. Look for the 6-foot leprechaun.
Yes. With the Black Lives Matter.
Yes, sir. Yes. Yes, sir. And here was another thing about branding that I didn't get forever. Try to please everyone. No one will be happy. There will be a lot of people if you try to please everyone. I'm a recovering nice guy. And I'm a recovering people pleaser. Those are trauma responses.
Yes.
I discovered that there's not just fight or flight when you're in the middle of trauma. It's fight, flight, fawn. Fight, flight, freeze, fawn.
I could add to that, which is make friends.
That's right. That's fawning.
Oh, that's the fawn. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Fawning. That's right. You're going to make friends with your enemy or they're going to kill you?
Yeah. Yeah.
By the way, I have a very Latin sensibility about that. I studied a lot about the French resistance. People call the French cheese eating surrender specialists. What I can tell you is that, they'll surrender so they can get close enough to you to poison your cheese. They'll surrender to your face so they can slice you up in your sleep.
Yeah.
We don't surrender.
No. Fight.
Right? So I discovered the difference only recently between nice and kindness.
Kindness, yes, and it's a difference.
Nice is a weapon employed by evil to groom their targets and their enablers. The quintessential thing that people say is, oh, he couldn't have done that. He's a nice guy. Oh, he was the nicest guy. Well, yeah, he killed 3 dozen people, but he's just the nicest guy. You'll see it a lot in domestic violence situations. Oh, they were such a nice person.
Nice, yes.
Yeah, nice is a weapon used by evil to groom their targets and their enablers. Kindness punches the nice right off of evil and rips it out by its roots. The Buddha wrote, if you lack the mercy to correct a friend, you are in fact their enemy. The way I describe it is, if I'm asleep and drunk at the wheel of a car and there's a brick on the accelerator and it's headed off a cliff and gonna land on a bunch of puppies, the kindest act you could ever do is to kick me bodily out of a fast moving car. That's kind. Nice would be not waking me up. So you'll see the things I post, they're part of my brand. One of my favorite pastimes is playing punch the nice off the evil. And if we can get, if we can intervene early enough, I will bend and break the evil off the nice before I have to play punch the nice off the evil. But either way, we're going in. Because to rid someone of evil is the kindest thing you can do. And it's a, you know, it's a coach thing. It's a, you know, I am hearing that the definition of a common mortal is a deluded Buddha. I am here to mend and break delusion. You know, like, you know, the delusion that you are not fantastically capable, world-class talent, and that you can learn what you really want to learn to be really good at that thing and make a lot of money. All of those things. And at some point during that process, it will be my job. I will have to earn my pay by doing violence to your delusions. If you're not, if, you know, the gentle approach isn't getting it done. And that's how in animal totem medicine, that's what's known as the badger medicine, honey badger medicine. Because even the bears give way to the badgers. They're the most vilest tempered animal on the face of the earth. And there's a very famous, you can go to YouTube and type it in. Somebody took it upon themselves to do funny voiceover for wildlife documentary footage.
Yeah.
And the famous one is, honey badger don't give a shit. And it follows the travels of, you know, honey badger versus cobra. Cobra keeps biting him, but he doesn't give a shit. He gets a, has a nice dinner, takes a nap, gets up and goes on as and finishes his dinner. Because honey badger don't give a shit. So I hope you're going to edit this down a little bit.
It's going to be raw. So
are you serious? Nice.
Yeah.
That's good. I mean, quite honestly, the unedited footage, and I must say, that is another one of your superpowers, is drawing people out. Because if I'd have took the time to prepare, if you'd have sent me some questions in advance and I took the time to prepare, there wouldn't be nearly this much juice.
Yes. Some people ask for questions. We send them questions. We never go to the question, you know, because the juice is in the message and the story and in the discovery of that, and the clarity that even comes from that, from even saying the story. You know, like every time we say our story or message, we get clarity, and that clarity is power that we can, you know, keep applying to help more people. I have one final question, which is, how do you find your superpower?
How do I find my superpower?
How does the guy listening to this now, you know, where can they start from? You know, of course, I mean, they would have to hire you, you know, or work with your company, work with you. But the guy probably would not be able to reach you, or who want to do something today, you know, to start off where they are at right now. How can they start to discover what they
should? A really good place to look. I love this question. This actually came from an outfit. The franchise is called, the concept's called Dependable Strengths. Hmm. And it arose after World War II when literally millions of Americans came, they got, you know, mustered out of uniform and out of, you know, out of the war materials factories because the war was over. And there was this economic paradox where everybody was unemployed and there was extreme demand to hire talent to rebuild the world. So everybody looking to hire somebody had no idea how to find them, and everybody looking for a job had no idea how to get it. And this is the greatest generation we're talking about. We're talking about Rosie the Riveter. We're talking about, there was a guy, I always like to use this example, when our boys, that it's from the book and the TV series Band of Brothers. When the 101st and 82nd Airborne, when the 101st Airborne dropped into France on June 6, 1944 in Normandy, there was no such thing as GPS or whatever, and a lot of the airplanes they dropped in on, they jumped out of, got shot out of the sky, and it was a giant mess. So everybody landed on the ground wherever they were in utter chaos in the middle of the night, and everybody's shooting at them. And so nobody was anywhere near their assigned objectives. So what they had to do is they had to, you know, figure out where they were and get to where they needed to be. And one Lieutenant Winters by name was about 8 miles away from where he was supposed to be. So you do what you got to do. You ruck up and you start humping and going and hiking and stuff. And he was double timing down a road on the way to his objective when he encountered a lot of very battle hardened, very veteran bad guys. And he was in the middle of the road all alone. But he had the presence of mind, because there was no place to hide because he was in the middle of the road. He had the presence of mind to start blasting away with his 7-shot rifle and got the drop on these guys and was able, he had startled them enough to where he was able to reload and such that he put a bunch of them on the ground and captured over 50 of them. Like serious tombstone-eyed, had already survived the Russian front, battle-hardened bad guys. Captured over 50 guys. Here's how he wrote it up in his report. That was an extreme, that every GI that ever put on a uniform will be able to confirm for you. Here's what he wrote in his report about that action, which is the stuff of legends, which is the stuff of, like, you couldn't make that up. If you saw it in a Hollywood movie, you'd call bullshit. No way. No, that would never happen. It happened. That's why I like to study history. Way more unlikely than fiction. He wrote up the report. It goes like this: encountered enemy, comma, captured some. Whereas you're a businessman, you're a business owner, you own many businesses, you hire people. If you don't know the whole backstory of what Lieutenant Winters did that day behind, you know, that he reported as encountered enemy, captured some, you'd immediately hit the hire button and find something for that guy to do.
Yeah.
And not just any old thing either. You would pay him well and do give him something like really important to do. Wouldn't you?
Yes.
Except for the part where if the thing crossed your desk and all it said was encountered enemy, captured some, you wouldn't know anything about that guy. You wouldn't know about his personality. You wouldn't know about what he can do under pressure. You wouldn't know about his ingenuity, his ability to think quickly. All those superpowers just left somewhere on, not on your, you know, not on your desk. So what that outfit did was they interviewed these people and they developed a whole thing around identifying all the superpowers, the dependable strengths. And the question they engage in is, the big question to ask is, I'll ask everybody that's watching this, what are some things, and I'd love you to make a top 10 list, what are some things that you have done that you're the one that did them, there's no way around, you can't argue your way out of that you didn't do them,
yeah,
that were very difficult, but that you also really enjoyed doing? So I did an exercise one time in that book, What Color Is Your Parachute? And I laid out a bunch of work tasks. You got to put one symbol next to the things you know how to do, another symbol next to the things you really like doing, and another symbol next to the things you're really good at. It was a revelation for me early in my, after bouncing around the workforce and a bunch of jobs I hated. There's a lot of things I'm really good at doing that I can't stand to do. But there are transferable personality traits that, you know, that would allow me to learn other stuff that I really did like doing. And those are my dependable strengths. Those are your superpowers.
So your superpower, let me see if I get this right, is the things that you are probably difficult to do, you know, and you enjoy, and also you enjoy the sweet spot between the things that was difficult to do, but you did, and you enjoy.
Yep. Yeah, that sweet spot in the Venn diagram in the middle, the overlap.
Yeah.
Those things, those are what we want to talk about, because you might have superpowers you never want to use because you hate them. Like my wife, great example. Best flyer you've ever seen in your life. She's the best. I'm really good. I'm really good, but she's the best liar I have ever seen.
Yeah.
Except for her parents instilled her with a conscience. And she finds it very annoying. Every once in a while, she'll go, damn, conscience. I could have lied my way out of that. That's an example. Her superpower of lying is one that she does not enjoy using.
So how do you transfer something like that into?
Well, in her case, I mean, she'd be brilliant at theater.
In theater, yes. Creative mind, yes.
She'd be brilliant as a performing artist when you need somebody to tell some preposterous whopper convincingly.
Yes.
You'd be the one you'd call. You'd want to call her first. And if it's using it, she likes to draw also the distinction using her powers for good. And I even tell her sometimes, honey, lie to me. If you want me to succeed, you're going to need to lie to me.
You lie to me.
You know, really. And she does, and it works. But, you know, yeah, that's why we narrow it down to five superpowers, because we have more, but we may not have any interest in flexing those.
So find and flex.
That's correct.
Powerful message. Thank you very much for sharing your story, your message. This was an awesome, amazing time. Thank you for sharing mine with me. You know, you know throughout the conversations, you were throwing some at me. You know, that was a gift. You know, thank you very much for sharing that as well.
Thank you. And I really look forward. I'm so glad we got to bond today. I'm really looking forward to a long and fruitful and fascinating friendship.
Thank you.